Back to the Licensed Spiel. I'm Thad Hitty.
I'm Carl Wonders.
And for the second time ever, we have a special guest.
Ooh, special guest. I feel special.
Joining us to discuss Short Fuse is the incomparable Ryan Riddle.
Well, it's good to be here. Columbo is my other fandom other than Star Trek and Babylon 5. So this is Columbo is within my Balawak, as he says in the episode.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. As longtime listeners to the show will know that Carl and I always find some reason to talk about Star Trek in every episode. So
there's plenty in this one, too.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep. All right, so this is Carl, what can you tell us about Short Fuse?
Well, I think we mentioned last time that this was an add-on episode that was requested by the producer or the studio. They had seen dailies of Columbo, thought it was coming together really well. I can't recall off the top of my head whether the show had actually started airing or not, but they said, well, we would like one more episode than you'd originally planned for. So this one was kind of thrown together rather quickly to satisfy the studio's request. I think it shows a little bit. I think that some of the story is a little half-baked in some places, and I think it could have done with a little more rewriting. Maybe some tweaks to the Roger Stanford character would have been nice. We'll talk about him. I find him to be a completely annoying creep throughout. But
would some of your tweaks be the wardrobe?
Well, that's another thing we will certainly talk about, and
there,
I will apologize.
There is no Short Fuse in Roddy McDowell.
No.
Just put it that way.
And here, I was going to make a Decker unit comment, but that's even better. I apologize to our listeners in advance for any specific show art that may pop up throughout the episode to illustrate what we're talking about here.
Let's go to the tape.
Yeah, this episode stars Roddy McDowell, who for some reason never actually quite made it to Star Trek somehow, but as far as I'm aware anyway, unless there's something I'm not thinking of.
I don't think he's ever
I know him from Planet of the Apes.
Planet of the Apes, Poseidon Adventure, few other movies from that era, but we have Star Trek covered by some of the other actors. We have William Wyndham returning for his second round, and James Gregory turns up, who was also lamentably killed in Star Trek as well as in this episode of Columbo. So
I was trying to figure out where I knew James Gregory from, and apparently it was everything.
I was going to say Planet of the Apes again, actually.
Yes. I don't think I scrolled back far enough. What was he in Star Trek?
He was Dr. Tristan Adams in Dagger of the Mind.
Oh, yes.
Yep.
Okay.
He was the one who's buttering up Kirk and, Van Gelder. Oh, poor Dr. Van Gelder. He was accosted by his own machine, and we're not doing anything bad on this planet.
Okay, yes, no, I do picture it now. That I wouldn't list that as one of my favorite episodes of Star Trek, but I do picture that one now.
Yeah, it's the one episode where Kirk has to be forced into being into the girl in the episode. So
yes,
it's a rarity in Star Trek.
It's also the episode that establishes that the Enterprise has a Christmas party.
It does.
Yes, it does.
And that's soon after we learn that it also celebrates Thanksgiving.
Funnily enough, there is also an episode of Columbo entitled Dagger of the Mind, and it is also not one of my favorite episodes of the show. Yes. But we'll get to that one later.
That is that, that if you're gonna write an episode of a show, don't use that title. It's a killer.
Oh yeah, he was on an Carl, he was also on an episode of Climax!
Was he really? Excellent. We talked about the original Casino Royale TV show episode from
Climax
TV show.
The one where it's like, oh, they're all James Bond? Yeah, that one? Yeah.
No. That's
oh, there was one more before that?
There was a TV movie in the 50s.
Oh, I didn't know about that. I only knew about the one like that had like all the well-known comedic actors as
James
Bond. Oh, yeah. We also watched that one. But no, there was a TV series in the 50s. It was an anthology show. They called it Climax with the exclamation point. And one of their episodes was a pretty faithful retelling of the book Casino Royale.
Really? Okay, I'm going to have to find this.
It's on YouTube. That's where we watched it.
Just for the name alone, that's a, there was no broadcasting standards that said, you know,
nope.
Maybe we might want to retitle this show.
I think that was the... They didn't think about that meaning of it.
Yeah, probably. Back it's then. The '50s, you know.
Yeah.
We're innocent, you know. It's Eisenhower's the president. Yeah, I get it.
Yeah. Yeah, Peter Lorre is Le Chief in that. Actually,
really? Okay, I'm gonna definitely after this. I'm.
I'll send you the link to it. I think I still have it somewhere.
Yeah. So I'm now I'm deadly curious. I did not know there was another Bond before there was Bond.
Jimmy Bond. He's an American in this one.
Oh, yeah, it is the only. It's the only Bond other than the early movies that's actually just based on a book.
Wow, that is
because it's from before awesome. From before the Eon production movies happened. So it's just based entirely on the book Casino Royale.
Wow, that's so fascinating.
Yeah,
that is so fascinating. It's but an American. It's like making Doctor.
It's an American show. Yes.
It's like, huh? But okay. But it sounds intriguing. And yeah. Casino Royale is a good book. So
Ryan, you mentioned you were a big fan of Columbo. How did that come about? Can you tell us a little bit about your history with the show?
Yeah, I used to see it on reruns, like when I was a kid. And some of the episodes were airing new when I was a kid. I think towards later the 80s, but I saw it mostly in reruns, and you know, it kind of just stuck in my head. And then the 90s ones came out, and I would watch. Yep. I watched those. And you know they were not as good, but you know I was a teenager by then, so I was kind of like, okay, these are kind of cool. And then I didn't really get really really into Columbo until maybe like 5 or 6 years ago. It had been on rerun, and I go, oh yeah, I know Columbo. I mean, you know, we all know the One More Thing, all the Peter Falk impressions, and all that. And so like I started watching it again, and I hadn't watched it in years. And I just went through all of them, and I was like, "I love this show. I love the conceit of it, that it's the reverse of how Ketchum is the is the term." And I love that Columbo is a cop who doesn't want to use a gun. He doesn't even want to carry a gun. Like there's an entire subplot in an episode where he's like refuses to take his shooting qualification. That's like years out of date already. he has no compunction about it. And also he does what I love about noir, and I consider Columbo noir in a way because he is going up against rich people. Those are his. Those are all the people he goes after. They're all rich. They're all powerful. They all have some sort of influence. Sometimes he sympathizes with them. Sometimes he doesn't. Sometimes they're complete horrid people, like, you know, Mr. Stanford in this episode with Roddy McDowell. And then other times they're very sympathetic. And you go, you understand why they committed the murder. But Columbo is Columbo. And he's got to bring him in at the end of the day. Right. Mm-hmm. He's still a man who's justice. And I like that he is sort of like this chubby, you know, kind of like cigar, cheap cigar, dollar cigar, smoking, unkempt person that brings down all these rich people. And it's just that is appealing to me as both someone on the left and as someone who loves noir. Because ultimately in noir, the real villain is capitalism, because that's what drives all these characters to commit all the things that they do.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the real villain is capitalism in everything.
Yeah, right. Exactly. That's right. True, too. Even in Star Trek. yep. You know, it's like, oh, Starship Captain went off the rails because he thought he could bring back capitalism. Fountain of Youth. I'm going to be rich. Jim. Okay. Anyway, but yeah, so I just kind of devoured, you know, all of them again. And you know, I don't remember certain ones. Like I remember the William Shatner one. I remember the Leonard Nimoy one. And cause those were the ones I saw the most, because obviously Leonard Nimoy and Shatner. But I watched all of them all the way through and I go, oh my God, this is like the perfect TV noir. It's just so perfect. And then you get to the 90s ones and it's okay.
Yeah.
I revisited them. I'm like, oh, it's very 90s. I got to tell you that. Mm-hmm. I love this idea of this detective. And I love that. I think it was, it was William Link who said that Columbo's sort of this guy that just sort of exists when he's needed. He just comes out. He just appears out of nowhere. And that's true in all these episodes. It's just like all of a sudden Columbo's there.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then he just sort of disappears at the end of the episode.
Yeah.
It's like he just exists as this sort of apparition of justice almost. And you know he knows who it is at the beginning. And it's not about like, oh, who did it? It's about, well, how is he going to entrap this guy? How is he? And trust me, a lot of what Columbo would not last in a DA case file.
We've talked about this
many times.
You're just like, what he does to Roddy McDowell in this episode, you're like, yeah.
I don't think he has a case.
Yeah, the DA would be like...
He actually confesses. He just like has breakdown.
Yeah.
He's like a little kid at the... you caught me in the cookie jar. Ha ha ha. But I do love that the character sort of just exists as this force in many of these stories. And it reminds me a lot about Lou Archer is the character. And I'm trying to think of Ross McDonald is the author. Mm. So he has these books called that are the Lou Archer series. It's his main detective. And Lou Archer only exists as almost like this like thin two-dimensional character that's only there as the lens for the drama of everyone around him. And that's kind of Columbo, right? It's not his story we're following. It's the story of the murderer and what drives them to commit the murder and everyone who's affected by that. And it's something that if you asked me this 10, 20 years ago, would I like this type of writing? No, because I was very much, oh, it's got to be about the main character. It's got to be about the lead, you know? I was one of those, you know, stubborn writers, right? But now I'm like, oh, that's actually a very interesting approach, especially for television. Where you can't have the main character, or at least at the time, you can't have the main character change at the end of the episode. Yeah. He's got to be back to the same person at the beginning of the next. And I love the format a lot. And I'm really glad that Rian Johnson sort of modernized Columbo with Poker Face, but also made it a way to make the main character a little bit more present and have their own arc as well. Which is very modern, but I like this format as a mystery show more than I like, oh, we got to find out who did it and da, 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 and put the clues together. No, we have all the clues. We're just waiting for Columbo to find the small lie within it.
No, and I like what you said about him staying. He's a very static and two-dimensional in a lot of ways. I mean, I don't think that would fly today, to your point.
No, that's why Rian Johnson had to modernize it a little bit.
Sure. I mean, he never goes home. We never see his wife. He never goes home. We know, like, that was the biggest thing that bothered me with the retelling of Sherlock Holmes was when they decided to talk more about the characters than the actual mysteries. Like, I didn't care about what Watson and Holmes do at home. I cared about them solving mysteries, you know.
And neither did Arthur Conan Doyle, because he couldn't get the name of Watson's wife right from story to story.
He couldn't get Watson's first name right sometimes.
What other names did he first names did he give?
It was Watson? Either James or John.
Yeah, I knew John was like the standard now.
That's the standard. Yeah. You could even remember the name of the housekeeper in just kind of like Mrs. Butterfinger. I don't know, whatever. She's not important. I'm making a penny a word. I've got to write her long story. So it is. But have you heard that? Have you guys discussed the theory that Columbo's wife doesn't actually exist, that he's just made her up as this tool? I love that theory, because if his wife exists, then it's Kate Mulgrew and she's only 22 and Mrs. Columbo.
At some point in that show, you meet Kate Mulgrew's husband and it's not Columbo?
No, that's okay. So here's the story, because I actually looked into it because I was very intrigued. Because I do remember when Kate Mulgrew was hired to be Janeway, I remembered her as like, oh, that's Columbo's wife. You know? And then I started looking into it, and she was like 22, and Peter Falk was pushing my age now, 50, and Kate Mulgrew was like, I'm going to be Columbo's wife. I could be his daughter. You want me to be? Okay, I'll be his wife. Sure. And so they did like this short series where she's a journalist, which I actually liked. And, you know, we never see Columbo. There's like the opening is her like putting away his cigars and you see the Peugeot and all that stuff. But you never see Columbo in the show. Like, you don't see Mrs. Columbo in the thing. But then like the network goes, this is not working. The creators of Columbo and even Peter Falk were like, we have no clue. We have no idea what this show is about. Like, Falk was like, I have a wife. She's my wife. She's like super young, which, you know, funny enough, he actually married someone that was quite younger than him. Yep. Anyway, but
say it ain't so. A Hollywood actor marrying someone quite younger than him?
I know. A May September romance? Not a Hollywood actor. But the network really just wanted Kate Mulgrew in a series, and they thought they could use Columbo as the way to get her a lead role. And then they decided to just drop all pretense of Columbo and then make it Kate Solves a Mystery.
Yep.
And they gave her a new name with a daughter, moved her to some other town, still a reporter, and she's divorced. So the husband you see in that is not supposed to be Columbo. It's
Gotcha. Okay.
It's like this weird parallel universe thing that happens. it's like the show just kind of all of a sudden goes, she's no longer Mrs. Columbo, she's her own thing. You're like, what? But you know, that was back in the 70s when you could do stuff like that and you could recast Darrens and no one would bat an eye.
I was gonna say it's a Dick Sargent kind of problem.
Yeah, on a bigger level, yes. So, but I do like the theory that Mrs. Columbo does not exist, and all of that is just his machinations to kind of...
I mean, I'm sure if you put together all his stories about his wife, you will find things that don't add up to all.
Of course,
Of course not. You know, I think it's his tool.
There's like one or two times I can think of where they show him on the phone with her and there's no one else around, so that kind of goes a little bit against... I like the theory. My guess is that the writers didn't really care one way or the other and just used her as an excuse to do things.
Yeah, you could even headcanon that as she does exist, but the Mrs. Columbo he talks about is complete fiction.
That
makes sense, Yeah.
That I can believe, because he's like, whatever I need to do to get this guy, you know, like you can see the wheels turning in his head.
Well, wasn't there that time you talked about his niece and he changed the name, like, in the middle of the story, episode?
Yeah. He's just like, I'm going to pull out some family relative that has some loose connection to what your interest is so that I can get you on my side.
Yep.
Right. But yeah, which I love. I love his, I love the bumbliness. And he's how I imagine the pre-crisis bumbling Clark Kent gets his stories. He does the same kind of thing. He just kind of bumbles to it because people underestimate him.
Yep.
But I love a character like that, that the villain will underestimate because, oh, I'm so much smarter than him. And he's so much smarter than they are. And he's just this chubby, unshaven cop, you know, who doesn't want to really be a cop. He's only a cop out of necessity to do what he's good at. Yeah.
And I think Falk doesn't get enough credit for how well he performs the role, because there are these definite moments. We haven't gotten to the one I'm thinking of really it's in the Nimoy one when he turns on a dime and is suddenly like all business and, gets in your face and is not, he kind of just sheds that whole persona and you finally see like the real person at times when it's called for.
Yeah, and I'm not going to spoil it too much for Thad, but when you get to that episode, it makes much more sense than the turn he does in Prescription Murder, because they hadn't found the character yet.
Right,
right.
So they didn't know what the right sort of like, you know, levers were for him. And Stephen Bochco tells this story with, because I nerd out. When I get into something, I really nerd out and I go deep. So I watched this where Stephen Bochco, creator of Hill Street Blues and NYPD Blue, discusses his time on Columbo. It was his first show. He wrote Murder by the Book, right? He wrote the first episode that aired. And he remembered he was writing it. And he was, you know, like, Columbo does this, Columbo does this, Columbo says all these things. And William Link said, take all that out. Let Falk do it. You just have to barely write Columbo. And so Falk is the one who really brings out all of those mannerisms. You can't write the mannerism. Like Link was like, you can't write what Falk's going to do because he's just going to do it. So you have to just give him the space to play with in that. You underwrite Columbo. You don't overwrite Columbo.
Yeah, there's that whole scene in this episode when they get into the tram and they go up the mountain. And Columbo has no dialogue, but you can see just by what Falk is doing that he hates heights and is uncomfortable the whole time. And that's just, I'm sure that none of that's on the page. Like that's just all that, him coming up with
comes,
that stuff.
That comes back in the Johnny Cash episode too.
Oh, yes, it does.
It's nice continuity. Mm-hmm. But yeah, his acting is fantastic. I'm like, even I was like, ooh, I'm also afraid of heights. Ooh, I don't want to do that.
and that's also a callback to Ransom for a Dead Man.
Oh, yes, that's right, because he goes in the plane with her, yes. Mm-hmm. Or he goes in the plane, yeah.
And she's like, here, take the wheel, and he's like,
I especially like, after he gets off the cable car, he just needs to stand there holding the rail for a little bit.
Yes.
He's also listless. He's sort of like listless, because he's like nauseous. Mm-hmm. It's like, that's great acting.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Like, there's very few actors that are very good at body language performance. Falk is one of them. Shatner's another. Most people don't credit these actors for that because they always see like either the hamminess or the overacting aspects and just focus on that. But if you look at these actors, they are in the scene as the character. And so their body language reflects each character. Because if you watch T.J. Hooker, Shatner's body language is not like his body language as Captain Kirk. It's completely different, you know. But Falk is really great in that scene. I really felt like I was in the tram with
him. Yeah. So why don't we talk a little bit about, we'll start talking about the episode here again. I will point out this is
not the worst rated episode of season one, according to IMDb.
Is it Dead Weight?
Yeah, Dead Weight is a little lower at 6.9. This one got 7.1.
Yeah.
Really? I thought Blueprint for a Murder would have gotten lower, but
that's just...
Oh, no, that's actually next season, is it?
That's the final episode of this season.
Yeah.
That one gets a 7.6, which is actually higher than Lady in Waiting.
Oh, okay. Because I've heard some very unfavorable reviews of Blueprint for a Murder, but I enjoyed it.
Death Lends a Hand is actually the highest rated one this season, which I personally think Suitable for Framing is my favorite. But
I'm a murderer. By the Book guy, because
Murder by the Book is also excellent.
Yes.
Yeah. I am a big Jack Cassidy fan whenever he's the antagonist.
Yes.
It's like, ooh, there's like sparks, you know?
Murder by the Book and Suitable for Framing are tied for the second highest of the season.
But Suitable for Framing has the best Catch 'em.
Yes.
For sure. the best catch.
Maybe of the whole series. Fingerprints. Sorry.
Yeah. Of the whole series. So when he does this, and he's just like,
I'm wearing gloves.
That look that Colombo has is just like, it's like so gold. Yeah, that guy's gold. Yeah.
Oh, and Ross Martin is so unlikable in that episode that you love seeing him get thrown in his face, too.
Speaking of unlikables.
The framing is what Carl showed me to get me hooked on Columbo.
That is actually a good, that is a good one to get you hooked on, yeah. I'm usually the guy that would be like, here, let's watch one of the Star Trek actor ones.
I think I was going to start with one of those, and then I, for whatever reason, decided not.
No, Suitable for Framing is a great one because that's a good one because you really want to see that guy and his frilly tuxedo get it.
Yes!
Another episode with interesting costume choices.
Yeah.
Other than the costume choices, you commented how the later seasons feel like the 90s. I am impressed at how timeless these episodes are.
Yes. Yes, yep. I agree.
Until you get to the answering machine.
Yes, I have that noted down.
Or when you know, a Columbo gets introduced to a Betamax and a Betamax recorder camera.
in that
episode. Yes.
Yep.
Yes, I definitely took note of the fact that answering machines were new enough that the answering machine had to explain what an answering machine is.
Yes.
And that car phones are a lot older than I thought they were.
Yes, actually, they go back as far as the 60s because Irwin Allen had a car phone.
They go back even farther than that. I want to say it was 1940 something was the first
car phone. I was going to say they're probably adapted from army equipment. Yeah. From World War II.
I know that Irwin Allen had one because there's this documentary about the making of Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, and he's like, I need to, and he's driving, and you're like, good lord.
Yeah, the first car phone was used in St. Louis, Missouri in 1946.
Okay. Wow. It's as old as my parents.
It's as old as my parents.
Mine too.
I shouldn't say that too loud. There's a parent in the other room. But I like that. Yeah, this show does feel very timeless. And the first season especially is the most visually experimental season as well. Yep. Yeah, it's very, very 70s movie sort of like, let's push the envelope.
I mean, you can... That was something I was thinking when we were, just talking in general about the show earlier, that how cinematic it is and how well it holds up and how good it looks. I mean,
it literally is a movie.
It clearly was shot on film. They got Steven Spielberg's, one of his first credits was, Murder by the Book.
He'd already directed a movie before he directed that episode. I think he directed the one about the
Express.
Truck driver.
Duel. Oh, Duel.
Duel. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he had already directed that, but he was still very nascent. He was on his way to Jaws. So
yeah. Well, and he did that one Night Gallery episode too.
Which is
also very,
very
experimental.
Show.
And
yeah, it's a very experimental show. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that was when Carl showed me Suitable for Framing. Oh, geez, this was 5 years ago now when we.
Took you that long to get him to watch the actual show?
Well, no. So here's the thing. So Carl showed me Suitable for Framing, and then I started watching it. And then we had already started doing License to Spiel at this point. And we said, hey, how about we do Columbo at some point? So I stopped watching because I'm like, I've been waiting to watch more Columbo.
Okay, good. You got you hooked. That is a good way to get you hooked.
But one of the things I commented on at the time was, wow, this looks really good for a 70s TV show.
I know. you compare this to Starsky and Hutch, and you're like, no comparison.
Right.
You know. And they took, they took like a month long to film these episodes, too. They took their time. Like, I know the one with the Commodore took...
Well, I mean, that was
production problems.
Well, between Falk was notorious for being slow and doing a lot of takes, and I think that was one of the Patrick McGoohan indulging himself episodes, if I remember correctly.
Yes. So. And that's another good duo too. When you get to
He shows up, I think three times,
quite
maybe?
Frequently. Yeah, like
three or four times.
Yeah, twice in the '70s show, twice in the '90s show, I think, and then he directs one.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Falk really loved Patrick McGoohan.
I think they were one of the few people to get both of them kind of straightened out in a way.
Yeah. Well, also, I think they both like to drink a lot. So
yes,
I also
that is true.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I mean, I just assume anyone in show business in the 70s had to be drinking like a fish.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Fox still of the generation that was just drinking. He wasn't doing anything else.
Nope.
Sorry, my dog, it might be in the background a little bit. So
that's all right. I say as I'm not the one that edits. Carl did try to get me into The Prisoner, but it didn't click for me.
Yeah, that's... that's one of a right place, right time, right mindset, maybe.
Yeah.
It doesn't stick with everyone, but and I can understand because Patrick McGoohan's very he talks in a very, very particular cadence that that can be off-putting for most people.
Yeah.
I am not a number.
It's those weird when he does like a falsetto voice for no reason out of nowhere sometimes. So it's just what?
Honestly, it was the giant white bouncy balls that I just couldn't.
that was originally going to be like a car, and it was supposed to come out of the water, and it went into the water and didn't come back out, and they're like, what do we do?
Yeah, they just sunk this. Like,
so they're like, we have some water, but we have some weather balloons. Let's use that.
They just sunk this experimental prop. Yeah. Into the beach of Port Marion, and we're like, well, it's gone.
So anyway.
Short
fuse. We are closer to the episode, right?
Yeah.
I keep getting you guys off track with others.
It's okay.
It's fine. Yeah. I can assure you we are no less off track than Carl and I normally are by ourselves.
Okay, good, good, good.
No. So I like the opening here. We see Roddy McDowell preparing something bad. I question why are you doing this in the dark, in the black, unless this is like light sensitive material.
He apparently just does all his experiments in the dark room.
In the dark. Yeah. Well, yeah, you can do it in the dark room, but you have a light in the dark room. Like,
I don't know.
Yeah, I thought at first that maybe it was light that triggered it, but then it couldn't be because it set it off at night.
Yeah.
Because he's also carrying it around in the daylight, too.
So. Yeah, true.
Well, the light of once you open it. Light
I see.
Cigars.
Once you open it. Okay, yeah. That makes sense. It just makes for a visually interesting beginning.
Yeah.
I guess in the dark it works, but if it hadn't been in the dark, that wire is very obvious.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That said, there wouldn't be enough time to like know, probably to stop it, and like you wouldn't know what it was when you first saw it, and you wouldn't. And once you blow up, it doesn't matter.
Yeah,
I think it's also shorthand to be like, oh, he's into photography, which is just
could
just
be
this
that,
odd
I mean, that comes
affectation
up later.
That the
I had this. I had the thought as watching this. I talked about how they're timeless, but I had the thought while watching this is I knew what this was immediately. But there are people younger than me that might not know what somebody working with chemicals in a red room is.
Yes. That's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. That is true. It's like the same youngins who don't remember, you know, payphones and stuff. Yeah. Gosh, I'm old.
Payphones do technically still exist.
They do. You see them. You know what? I love seeing them in Britain
them in
where they just become like, that's where everyone throws their trash into the red phone booths now.
But you still see them in airports usually because
that's
obviously
true.
That's
true.
A useful thing to have when you're traveling internationally and whatnot.
I miss the days when I could just leave the house and no one could reach me unless I met them at a particular place at a particular, like, you, when you made plans, you made plans. You were no backing out.
Yeah.
There was no like texting, you know what, I'm not feeling well. You know, you actually had to go to the place and tell them, you know, maybe not tonight.
I recall calling my parents from the mall and including,
yes, me too.
Come pick me up as my name in the collect call.
Yeah.
For, you know, not useful at all, but I remember the number to call to get the time and temperature in the town I was growing up.
That was useful back in the day.
It was, yeah. Yeah.
Unlike Roddy McDowell's character.
I will say, yes, Roddy McDowell's character is a terrible person, but I do feel a little for him about being forced out of the company and forced to sell the company.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's technically his parents' company, isn't it?
That, right. It was his dad's company. Yeah.
It was his dad's company, right? And see, this is one of those ones where it's like you want to sympathize. Like, I do like the ones where Columbo sympathizes with the plight of the person mm-hmm. who committed the murder. But this is just one where the character's just so spoiled and so entitled and so everything that the boomers say that every generation after them was. They just want to strangle the man. He's obnoxious. Like, he sprays the...
Oh, God, yes, yeah.
On the
silly
on
string.
The silly string
the
stuff.
The silly string like... on the receptionist. And, you know, this poor girl's just trying to type her memo and, you know, get out of work, you know. And he just also feels like a user. Even his relationship with Anne Francis's character just feels like a complete lie and manipulation. It's like he's not really into her. He just needs her to get something out of her. And so there's no redeeming qualities in him. There's none. I can't find any.
No, I mean, yeah, I agree that I put it down to the writing rather than the performance, I think, because Roddy McDowell was capable of
all kinds of things. Out of it.
Yeah.
He's chewing every scene and Peter Falk at the same time.
Mm-hmm. But, his circumstances that lead up to the murder itself are, you know, you're supposed to maybe feel bad for the guy, but he just makes it impossible to.
He does. He makes it impossible. Yeah.
And I do appreciate, though, things like there's that guy that is sort of like the floor manager of the receptionist pool there, and how he kind of cows before him at the beginning here. And then later on, he kind of tells him off, and, you know, they're really putting up with him because he is the son of,
right,
you know, the guy that owns the company, and that's the only reason they tolerate him.
Yeah.
And you don't even feel sympathy for him when you tell when he talks about his parents having died in an accident, because he just, there's no anything in him.
No.
Like, there's no compassion. There's no emotion behind, everything's so calculated and very, very also very heavily coded queer.
Absolutely, for sure. Yes.
Character.
Yes.
Like Roddy McDowell is like, he's like the twink, right? He's mm-hmm. the evil twink, right? In a lot of this. And, you know, even the scene where he's like picking this silly string out of Falk, it's like there's like this underlying homoeroticism about it, right? long line of queer villains. But there's nothing else to hang on to with him.
No.
Like, I don't feel anything for him. Not even like just a little bit of like, oh, you know, you got screwed out of your fortune. But there's no, even with his aunt, there's like this manipulation, and it's just so
100%,
disgusting to watch, you know.
He just uses every single person. He has every no actual attachment to any of them.
Yeah, and he's obnoxious as all get out. You know, he's got the camera and he's constantly taking candids of everything and everyone and laughing as if there's some joke that just got told that only he heard. It's just, he's so obnoxious. Smack him in every scene that he's in. But he's also captivating to watch at the same time. Mm-hmm. And not just because of the costuming.
Okay, so that denim suit that he wears at the beginning is a very 70s outfit.
It is a very 70s outfit, yeah. And very, like, I don't know if he's going to the discotheque afterwards.
Like, yeah. Yeah.
No, but it is very, like, and then he wears that heavy honors medallion that is kind of like the Studio 64 medallion, but for honor students.
Right.
Yes, that's certainly a choice. Although I do love that he gives it to Columbo at the end.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, and that's another thing too. They keep talking about how he's this genius, or and it's never shown to us. It's always told to us. I mean, yes, he makes a bomb. I guess he makes the bomb, but other than that, like,
other than that, you just hear that he has a doctorate and he's a lawyer and this and that and
yeah,
and he has his Beckett and he has his Leonard McCoy retirement medallion. You know,
yeah. Him and McCoy were at Studio 254. You know,
yeah.
He's just, there's just, and maybe you're right. It is the writing. If they had taken this for another pass or two, mm-hmm. you know, if they weren't, cause you know, television is a grind, especially back then. Like if mm-hmm. you didn't have a script and you had a shooting date and you didn't have a script, you're screwed.
Yeah.
I mean, and a lot of all that hatred towards Roddenberry about rewriting scripts wasn't really about just stealing credit, was also making sure that the script was ready
yeah.
for shooting on Monday, you know, when the script wasn't. Like John F. D. Black's script was completely not ready, and Roddenberry had to spend an entire weekend making it ready. So that's just television back then, even television today in some cases. So I get it, but God, man, if they could only have one more pass or two.
Yeah.
Like, oh,
I mean, it's worth mentioning that Jackson Gillis wrote the script for this episode, and he's the person that also wrote Suitable for Framing,
right?
And he wrote like 8 or 9 episodes of mixed quality, I'll say, but
right.
Actually, a lot of them are not great.
Television, so, sometimes but, you're not going to always bat 100.
No,
you're gonna have some foul balls every once in a while.
For sure,
this was really a foul ball in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's just we don't get told. We just have to assume that he is. He doesn't have any innovative. Like if they had made it where like he had like he was on the verge of something innovative that would have brought the company more notoriety or more fame. And he was trying, he just needed that extra few months or whatever. He had to postpone the sale. Something, some other motivation other than, I just want the company.
Right.
Would have really gone a long way.
It sounds like he really just likes to play in his laboratory.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like he doesn't really have an interest in the company. So I don't get why he wants to off his uncle. I mean, his uncle is kind of terrible, but yes. He's not that terrible.
So
didn't warrant his murder.
he is being blackmailed after all. But
yeah, no, there's absolutely motive. But so his uncle, James Gregory's character, is the painting on his desk, is that himself or is that supposed to be Roddy McDowell's dead father?
I think it's him because at the end of the episode, it's on his desk and he covers it. And then
he could have been trying to hide his father too. He could have been like feeling slightly ashamed, maybe.
I thought it was James Gregory.
Would you have a painting of yourself on your desk?
So that because it could stare at him and taunt him
CEO.
Later.
CEO.
Yeah.
I think Elon has like 12. He has none of his kids, but he has 12 of himself.
And similarly, because we had another character that also had this, at his house on the coffee table is a framed photo of himself.
Both of them got murdered.
Because of their vanity.
Apparently. Yeah.
They committed the sin of vanity. No.
Yeah, no, it was the guy in Lady in Waiting.
It was Mr. Bryce. It was Bryce, yeah.
He had a photo of himself on his coffee table. Not like with family or anything, just a him. Portrait of himself. I can tell you right now, nowhere in my house will you find a framed photo of me by myself.
No, not just with
Star Trek people.
Yes, yeah. You will find framed photos of me with Star Trek actors. That's a whole perfectly other fine. Thing.
Yeah, I don't myself, but I actually have friends that have photos of themselves solo framed in their houses.
Is it like themselves at a famous event or something like that? Doing something fancy?
Sometimes it's also just a portrait.
That's weird.
I know.
I know what I look like. Yes.
I know what I look like, and that's why I don't have photos of myself.
it's like that line from Back to School. I've got a body you can donate to science fiction. So,
there's a movie I haven't thought about in a hot minute.
I know. It also has a Star Trek connection because it's the first movie that Terrell Farrell ever did after modeling.
So I kind of wish we got obviously we can't because the character's dead. I thought it would have been awesome to get a spin-off starring chauffeur/private detective Quincy.
I know, right?
Yeah. that was a great character.
He's pretty awesome at his job, yeah.
I'm like the dual role of chauffeur and private detective. I could see that Quincy chauffeur PI.
I want to know what happened with the car that was reported stolen.
Yeah,
that was one of the blackmailing things. He just throws that out like, so what happened?
And also, what drugs? Like, I was like intrigued. I'm like, it can't be pot. It's gotta be like hash or heroin or coke or something, right? He doesn't seem like he's just a pot guy.
No.
And what's he selling? That's what I thought. I was like, oh, he was making it. That's what I thought immediately.
That's my guess.
He was making and selling it. You know, he was going Breaking Bad before Walter White.
Yeah, except he didn't need to. But yeah, it's just called it the drug thing in college.
Yes. It's like, that's a Hollywood writer just going like, I don't know, whatever, drug thing in college. I don't care.
Yeah.
I also like how he says item before each one.
Item. Yes.
The drug thing in college. Because he's like item, which implies that it's going to be a very specific thing. And then he just uses generalities as in the drug thing. The mess in Acapulco.
I don't see how gambling in Vegas quite stacks up even then. Yeah. But
unless it was like a four rooms thing and he got into trouble or something. I don't know.
You're the best combination chauffeur and private detective in the business. Probably the only one, but
yeah. I don't know many calls for that particular line of work. Speaking of guest cast though, Ida Lupino is really not used well in this episode.
No.
She's like there and then she's not. And it's like such a waste because you have this fantastic icon of noir and you don't have her do much of anything meaty other than, oh, do you think he was murdered? Oh, Roger, do you think your uncle was murdered?
Yeah, Anne Francis gets way more screen time.
Yeah, Anne Francis.
She's pretty wasted in this too, but
yes.
Well, at least she lives through the episode.
That's, you know? Unlike the other one she's in.
She's dispatched rather quick, but she's it's just a waste of these two wonderful actresses. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm surprised they didn't get Lupino to try to direct one of these. Because she's a really great noir director.
And Anne Francis has a spiritual Star Trek connection because she was in Forbidden Planet, which
that's true
was one of Roddenberry's influences.
And also, she was in a lot of Short Skirts, which you know, obviously Star Trek loved.
Yep. Also, that ties her back to Columbo again because Leslie Nielsen.
Yep, Leslie Nielsen.
Oh yeah, he's also Forbidden in Planet, an episode. Yep. Yeah. He's also in an episode right before he makes his comedic turn as an actor.
Yep.
Yeah, he was in the last episode.
I remember. Yeah. And then we also have Decker in this one.
Yes. Ah, I love William Wounded. He's also not used a lot in this episode.
He's not, but I like that he's in on the climax. I mean,
the final scene, of course.
Yeah. I love that he's in on the, you know, on the gag at the end, you know.
Yes.
To get the guy, you know, and making him sweat.
Oh yeah, no, for 100%. And I also we the audience knew what was happening with that from the beginning.
Yeah. We're in on the gag. Yeah.
I did not realize that William Wyndham was also in on the gag. Until he says, "Where did you get the cigars, by the way?" And they're like,
I love it's also very interestingly shot. There's like this episode isn't as experimental as some of the earlier ones, but it has some nice, like the whole, like the clock ticking, him looking at the watch, those things. But the tram sequence is really well staged, and you can see the claustrophobia whenever you cut to Roddy McDowall, like just the wall is closing in on him, and he's like, "Oh, we got to get rid of the box," and then he goes completely mad. It's just a wonderfully shot and staged scene, and I don't know how many times they had to do it because they would have to go up and down and up and down for every take,
right?
You know.
Yeah, I neglected to mention. So Edward Abrams is the director, and he was the editor on a lot of the earlier episodes, and they gave it to him just because they figured, well, one, he would do a decent job of it, they thought, and two, if you have the editor also shooting it, it might go a little bit faster and be ready to be aired.
Yeah, because he can cut it in his head.
and I agree. I think there's some interesting cutting that happens in this, and you can tell an editor kind of thought through some of the.
I would watch Short Fuse over Nemesis, Into Darkness, or Section 31.
Yes. Yeah, me too. Me too. Yes. Only just for Roddy McDowall, though, because he really makes a meal out of the most he's given here.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, you can certainly see the meal he's serving in one scene.
Yes. Yeah. He was wearing the pirate shirt before Seinfeld made it popular, right? The poofy shirt.
Yeah.
Except that's not what you're watching in that scene.
No.
I will say, Carl warned me about the package, but I was not prepared for the ass shots.
Oh, yeah. Oh, there's a couple. He puts his booty out there a couple of times.
Yeah, and it's like a close-up shot from behind the stairs as he's going.
Yeah.
Going down the stairs,
And like, those pants are painted on. Like, what the hell?
My pants weren't as tight when I was living in San Francisco and going to the Castro at night. So, Roddy McDowall, he somehow gated up more than I did when I lived in San Francisco. So, he's like, the costume designer must have been having like real fun with Roddy McDowall.
Yeah.
I just want to know what the fitting was like when he wore the denim pants that we all really remember him in, or the polyester blue pants that we all remember him in.
Polyester was it. Yeah.
She's like, I don't think I need to take your inseam now. We can see your inseam. And it just stays there. It doesn't move either.
No.
In every scene, it's like, was there a continuity guy that had to check if it was still in the same position? That and the tram scene are the two most memorable things about this episode. when Carl messaged me, "Hey, we're going to talk about Short Fuse. I think you'd have something to say about Roddy McDowall." Well, yes, Roddy and his McDowells. Yes, I have a lot to say about those.
To be clear, that is not why I asked you to join us on this.
I know.
I mean, Carl, when you said, "Hey, Ryan Riddle wants to join us," I think you even said to talk about Roddy McDowell's
pants.
Yes, you pants. Used the word pants.
I did use the word pants. This was after we had discussed
Yes.
Yeah. Ryan Riddle has expressed interest in joining one of her Columbo episodes, possibly to talk about Roddy McDowell's tight pants, but also in general.
If you're going to talk about... there are, you know, maybe it's a thematic thing. There's cigars, there's junk, you know, it's, okay. It's all phallic. It's all... It's
I want to talk about Freudian. The cigars for a second.
Okay, yeah, please. You're a connoisseur of them, so...
So these are really fancy Cuban cigars that are not exactly easy to come by because, well, especially in the 70s.
Yes.
And they all just keep them in boxes in their cabinets.
Yeah. But they're locked. What? They're locked.
No. That's not my point.
I know where you're going. Okay. Yeah.
My point is, these cigars are dry. These expensive cigars are drying out in people's cabinets.
Yes. There is no humidor being used, right?
Like I do understand. There was a time, and that back then would have been the time when people often would buy a box of cigars to use for the week, and they wouldn't have a humidor. They just buy their weekly box of cigars.
Yeah,
but that's not what's happening here.
Yeah,
William Wyndham had four of them, and
there's like a whole like stack of them, right?
So like, and these they established they came from Cuba, that they're extremely rare, extremely expensive. Like, why are you not storing them so that they will stay good? People did have humidors in the 70s. I checked to make sure that it wasn't this wasn't like sometime in the 90s we suddenly realized cigars needed humidity or something.
I'm sure they did, but let me assuage you, when they get to wine and wine storage, they do a better job later on.
Yeah.
So they make for it in another episode with wine. Although that is an interesting point, because they could have used the humidor as like a thing in the episode that kind of points to some shenanigans with the cigars. That would have been interesting.
Yeah, and like rich people absolutely would be the kind of people that would have like, they'd have a humidor with a glass door so they could display their cigars and people can see them and be, you know.
They wouldn't store them in the filing cabinet.
Although, no, I understand keeping your... Well, no, because it's not like they're even really trying to hide them. They'll still use them in public, so it's not like the fact that they're Cuban means they have to hide them.
Yeah. No. That would have been great had they had a humidor in this one, and then they could have used it like they do in any port.
I will say, the thing where the cigars are all in individual tubes, that is a thing. Some cigar brands do that. It's more of an affectation than anything else. It's not like keeping a cigar in a tube will, like, you know, make it a better cigar than not keeping it in a tube.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a running thing on this podcast that I will complain about people not using cigars correctly and things.
I understand. I have the same thing with journalists in TV shows. Whenever I see one, like, I go off
technology
for hours.
And cigars, I will complain about forever.
Would it surprise you that I made a note about Roddy McDowell's bourbon in a tall glass again?
I made a note about yet another person with a bar with an ice bucket.
Yes.
Okay,
apparently, so everybody in the 70s has bars with ice buckets.
Yeah, you know, we had an ice bucket when I was a kid. We didn't have a bar, but we had an ice bucket. The bourbon in a tall glass, it's a thing in Columbo. It comes up quite often. I can excuse it in some episodes because the character in themselves is alcoholic, but it's just like when everyone is just like, here, it's like, what are you guys doing?
Here's a giant ice cube and a little bit of bourbon in a tall glass that we're going to stir around. Yeah.
I think it's because tea is cheaper to get. So maybe, you know, that's everyone's bourbon, I guess. I don't know.
I mean, it's still better than Live and Let Die when Roger Moore orders bourbon and water.
Bourbon and branch water, yeah.
I haven't seen that one in a long time.
I mean, you're not missing much.
No, I know. I'm not much of a connoisseur of the Moore era of Bond films.
He orders it without ice, and the guy's like, "That'll be extra." When he goes to the bar in Harlem.
I really like Roger Moore as Bond.
Yeah, he's good. He was my childhood Bond. Yeah.
In the beginning, I believe I referred to it in our License to Spiel episodes as the Mankiewicz trilogy of suck. So Diamonds Are Forever, Live and Let Die, and Man with the Golden Gun.
Mm-hmm.
Not great movies, and I'm honestly impressed the franchise continued after those three in a row.
Yeah, I think Moore has the track record of the most stinkers. Because you get the gold one, right? You get like for Your Eyes Only, and that's like great. That's a great flick. And
for Your Eyes Only, other than like the creepy figure skater stuff, but yes.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I love Moonraker.
Mm-hmm. Me too. We both.
Well, I have a Star Trek Moonraker connection.
Oh.
Ken Adams designed all the Bond sets, right?
Yeah.
The Moonraker base is his unused design of what the interior of the Enterprise would have looked like in Planet of the Titans when Ken Adams was the production designer.
Really?
Oh, cool.
Okay.
Yeah, he wanted to like really like open up the ship, and like I think Roddenberry Archive has what his bridge design was, and it's sort of similar to that. But then he also has this other sketch where you see deeper in the ship, and it's all these tubes crossing each other and all that stuff. He really wanted to see. He was like, let's see the inside and make it big.
So, and The Spy Who Loved Me is also a good movie.
That's a good one. Yeah, that is a good one. Yeah.
But then, yeah, Moore should have retired after For Your Eyes Only.
Yeah, yes. Because by View to a Kill, you're like,
I mean,
maybe.
It is telling that he was, in fact, older than Sean Connery.
Yeah.
When he Roger Moore, the man,
just period,
was
just
older
period.
Than
yes.
Sean Connery.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And A View to a Kill has a killer song, but that movie is
How to Waste Christopher Walken.
But Octopussy has a Star Trek connection.
Mm.
Tell me. I haven't seen Octopussy in so long. It's a fun thing to say.
Carl, I can't remember his name. Tell him.
What?
I'm trying to think.
Oh, VJ Armitage. That's right. Yeah, VJ Armitage plays VJ creatively in Octopussy, the sidekick in India, and he's the guy that is on the screen in Star Trek 4.
Oh,
trying
yeah!
To deploy the makeshift.
He's going to deploy a makeshift solar sail.
Isn't Jane Wheedlin the other captain that's on screen with the weird hair? Jane Wheedlin, or however you say her name, from the Go-Go's.
Yes, she is. Yes.
Yeah.
Because I remember,
okay.
I remember MTV made a big deal about that. So
she's also the singing telegram girl from Clue, but
that's her better part, I think, because
yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
Scene.
and to bring this back around to Columbo, Octopussy has a Columbo connection because Louis Jourdan shows up as a murderer at one point.
Ah.
Not for a while, though.
Ah, see, we've made it come full circle.
Yeah.
we've arrived back at Columbo.
We always do eventually, but
we do eventually.
My one more thing about A View to a Kill. You mentioned it has a good song. My favorite part is about related to the song is when you have Roger Moore leaving a burning building while Dance Into the Fire is
played.
Yes. Okay,
like,
so
technically he's dancing out of the fire right now.
Right.
View to a Kill, I saw in the theaters as a kid because my parents would always take me to all the Bond films when they came out. Mm-hmm. My parents had no compunction of like R rating or whatever. They just took me to whatever they were watching, right? And I remember like, oh, like the Golden Gate stuff and like Silicon Valley, and that when I was a kid, I believed, oh, Silicon Valley, well, that's where they make all this, the chips, the computer chips. No, I live there and I worked in tech. None of that stuff happens in Silicon Valley.
It's where they design the
Synth. Yeah, yeah, that's right. Where we design it. Right. They ship it somewhere else, right? Mm-hmm. But what's also funny
that's
is...
That's why every Mac is designed by Apple in California.
Yeah, exactly. And the map that Bond looks at, and it's like San Francisco, and this generic, like, Silicon Valley.
Yes.
There are individual cities it lumps like San Jose and like all these like bedroom communities into this like amorphous thing called Silicon Valley.
Silicon Valley.
I find it so hilarious.
Tell me this was made by British people without telling me. It's made by British people.
I'm surprised. Like I don't know how much. Like I'd have to rewatch it, and I watched it again a few years ago, but I have to rewatch some of it because I'm pretty sure. None of it was really filmed in San Francisco.
No, I mean, I think they probably had some very, you know, obviously establishing shots of the bridge and all that stuff. But
that's all
unit, you know.
Yeah, that's all or stock, one of the two, right?
Yeah.
Or unlike Star Trek IV, which was actually filmed in the city. So
well, I think the reason that Zorin's blimp and color scheme is the way it is because they just used footage of like the Fuji film blimp.
Oh, really? Oh, that makes sense.
I think so.
because you could tell towards the end of Moore's run that they were really getting cheaper and cheaper with the films.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so I'm a fan of the Timothy Dalton ones. So.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Me too.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of Timothy Dalton as Bond because he's very close to the Bond in the books. And
mm-hmm. Yep.
Mm-hmm. He's the rugged one before they tried again with Daniel Craig.
Yeah. Right?
And I can see why he was unpopular at the time because you're coming off Roger Moore, so you're used to that.
Well, I mean, as a '90s kid, I prefer Pierce Brosnan to Timothy Dalton, but
I can see that too. Yeah, yeah. I like Timothy Dalton.
I like all of the Bonds. George Lazenby is definitely last for me, but I do like all of the Bonds.
You mean the catalog model that they just roped into being Bond?
Yep.
Because Timothy Dalton was too young to play Bond, and that's who they thought they were going to get first. They're like, oh, wait,
you did Line in Winter. Come be Bond. Yeah, he was like 23.
Yeah, it's like, I can't. I'm only 23.
I can't. Yeah, no.
I don't think I have a problem with any Bond, really. I mean, other than George Lazenby. But he has the best story, though. That is like
what
the
do
best
you, What
Bond
do you
story.
Think about the Tom Holland rumors?
Oh, for God's sakes, no. I think Zendaya is a fantastic actress, and I wish they had cast her as Ulysses instead of Penelope, because I think that would make a far more interesting movie. But I cannot stand Timothy Chalamet or Tom Holland in another thing being shoved down my throat one more time.
I know.
I mean, I love Tom Holland. I think he's a great Peter. I think he's a great Spider-Man. But it's
he
just
was
like
excellent as Spider-Man. But yes, I'm not.
He's
sure
not
I
a
see
Bond. That's like getting a maybe James Bond Jr.
if now,
anyone but... remembers that canon.
Oh, we talked through all of the amazing villains in that show.
I remember the toys. I think I had one of the figures.
I watched part of one episode, and I noticed that the credits font is the same as Star Trek TNG's.
Is it really? Oh, I'm gonna have to go back and watch it because it's just that era where they took all these movies and decided we're gonna make cartoons. Like we're gonna take RoboCop, the most violent thing imaginable, and turn it into a toy line and a cartoon. And we're going to take Police Academy, and we're going to turn it into a cartoon and a toy line.
Well, the toys I remember had, you had like the roll snaps you could put in the thing and flick the thing in the back of the thing and shoot the guns. And this is a good idea. But yeah, they had James Bond Jr. They had the Back to the Future cartoon.
Yeah,
I remember
the
around the same
cartoon.
Time.
The Back to the Future cartoon
the
wasn't.
The real Ghostbusters.
That one,
do not knock the real Ghostbusters.
That is the best one.
That's J. Michael Straczynski.
Yeah, yeah, that's the best one. That is the best adaptation. I also love the episode where they make fun of the movie, where they're like, "What would you get Robert Redford to play me? Bill Murray? Who the hell is Bill Murray?"
My favorite, thing is,
I don't sound a thing like that.
The guy they have to play Venkman is Garfield. Is the voice of Garfield, and then Bill Murray was the voice of Garfield in the movie.
Yes.
Which is something that they mention again in Rick and Morty, and like I felt like my friend didn't get the reference. He goes, "Wait, Garfield was in Ghostbusters?" And I had to explain to him the whole cycle of voice acting that resulted in that joke. Mm-hmm. He was not old enough.
He has no idea who Lorenzo Music is.
Yeah. One of the greatest cartoon voice actors ever.
Yep.
Lorenzo Music.
Even though and he sounded exactly the same every time.
Yeah.
Man, we haven't even got to the murder yet.
I know. Okay, so there's a body.
Anyway, yes, the murder.
Yeah, anyway, the murder.
We get your astigmatism headlights again.
Yes, I noted that.
We've been commenting about how every time you see headlights in Columbo, they have the big stretched out light beams in all directions.
Like, oh, yes, yes. I suffer from that sometimes.
I see that. I'll see if I take my glasses off.
I find this whole sequence, this montage, kind of hilarious with like the background music and the animated lightning bolts and
and watching them talk but not being able to hear what they say,
but you know what they're talking about in the car because it's already been set up. And then Roddy McDowell trying to hit on Anne Francis while breathing cigar smoke in her face while they watch weird go-go dancers.
And she's like fine with him breathing cigar smoke in her face, too. That was the part that was wild to me.
Yeah.
But I think it also goes to Roddy McDowell just being a complete freaking tool, dude.
Well, yes.
Yeah, I think it's just him being a tool. And that Anne Francis is so meek and... I wish she had a better role in this one because she's so like that stereotypical female character that's easily manipulated by the villain. Mm-hmm. That was such a trope in the old Star Trek and in trope in a lot of 60s and 70s shows and 80s, even in the 80s. Oh, it's even worse in the 80s.
Yep.
But yeah, he's just being a tool. That is an interesting montage because it's like you're trying. It's a little experimental still. It's still a little experimental for Columbo. And
I like he keeps checking his watch while he's with Anne Francis, but he couldn't possibly know at exactly what time.
No, it was he couldn't happen.
No,
yeah, because he didn't know when he was going to want a cigar and all that stuff. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, Roddy McDowell tried to set her up too with the cigar case.
Yep.
He was trying to insinuate that maybe she did it, as if she had the knowledge to build a specific time-fused incendiary.
So I actually didn't read it that way. I read it as him knowing that he had to make sure the cigar case would be found to avoid suspicion.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. Yeah, so I just read it as him as a potential...
He came up with a plausible explanation for what happened to the cigar case, and that's why he left it there under the desk.
Right. Like it felt because his coat was piled up on the thing, and maybe it fell out and went under the desk.
Yeah.
And then he takes the cigars out of the glove compartment and to make sure that he has to open the box. Yeah, I think I'm with that. I think that that's more just to make sure what his plan goes off.
I do think he was hoping that William Wyndham would get set up
for I think that's where I'm making the connection, the leap. I just think he's trying to frame everyone.
Oh yeah.
He's such a
and then we see him go into Quincy's apartment, which I guess is above the garage, and steal a typewriter because we have this stupid subplot that makes no sense at all.
Yeah.
Well, this is how Columbo gets into people's heads, makes them do dumb things.
So why is Columbo there at this point?
Because it's a missing person.
Because it's a missing person. It's not a homicide, and it's because it's we're watching Columbo.
Yeah.
There are a couple times when this happens where Columbo shows up to not a murder yet.
But, and... Okay, the setup is very similar in my mind to Ransom for a Dead Man. It's mm-hmm. very similar in stuff. In fact, Ida Lupino's mansion is almost the exact same set redressed from Ransom for a Dead
Man. Mm. Lee Grant's house.
Lee Grant's house. Oh, God, yeah. She's so great,
isn't she?
I love Lee Grant. It's almost the same setup, right? There's a missing person, mm-hmm. and Columbo shows up, and it's like I don't remember because it's been a while since I've seen Ransom for a Dead Man. I don't remember exactly if there was an explanation for why Columbo was there when it was a ransom situation.
He was attached to like the local police presence or something.
Yeah.
That really doesn't make any sense.
There's no explanation. It's just kind of hand waved, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's just a case of Columbo was the only detective still in the department when the call came in, and they're like, mm-hmm. "Hey, you got nothing else to do right now, do you? Why don't you go take this missing persons case?" But they don't even do that.
Well, there's a moment where Ida Lupino says that she called the police, and I guess, you know, she's an important person, so she gets to talk to the higher up, and they said, "We'll send over my best man on the job." And that's when Columbo makes the comment about my wife thinks I'm second best and that there's 80 fellows tied for first, which is kind of cute.
I wonder if perhaps she told the police commissioner or whoever she called that she thinks it might have been a murder.
Maybe.
That might be it, too, because she is very suspicious that something afoul has happened already.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's like, oh, maybe it's like one of these people that has a business interest and yada, yada, yada. Someone gave us a stink bomb, which I just think is Roddy McDowell was the one.
Yeah, I think, yeah.
It's like a childish thing that he would do. But yeah, I think these are things that would have probably been smoothed out if they were given another chance to mm-hmm. do another draft instead of having to have something ready to shoot. You know, so it's always the little things for us writers, and it's always the little things that everyone catches us on. They're like, "Oh yeah, why didn't you do the thing and the thing?" And you're like, "Oh God, no, why do you remember that?"
Yeah, why you hoping you wouldn't that? See that. Or, yeah, yeah. This is where we get that really old answering machine.
Yes, that explains what an answering machine is.
Mm-hmm.
That probably cost like $5,000 back then.
Yes.
Five grand in 1970s money. Yeah.
1970s money. Yeah. Just like the original Betamaxes were like $5,000 when they came out. Yeah. And only the rich would have it, right?
Of course. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it's a recurring thing when Columbo encounters these newfangled gadgets that he's never seen before because they're out of his, you know, he doesn't make enough money to even know what they are. So.
He's driving a classic Peugeot after all.
Could use
a paint job.
I mean, Columbo encountering the newfangled gadgets reminds me of that scene in Death of a Salesman when he encounters the rich guy that's recording a radio broadcast.
Yep.
There's a lot of Willy Loman in Columbo.
There is a lot of Willy Loman in Columbo.
that's a good analogy. I never thought of it that way. Yeah, there is a lot of, right down to the trench coat. Which apparently is Fox's actual coat. So.
Yep.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Was his actual coat the whole time?
I think so.
Okay.
I think so, yeah.
I was just wondering because Prescription Murder? Was that the title of the first one?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like neat and unwrinkled. That's what I was wondering.
Yeah.
You were still trying to find the character then.
I believe we referred to it as the Columbo is too shoveled in that one.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it is very interesting to see that Columbo and then watch the Columbo that happens in the series. And there's still a little like in the early episodes still trying to figure out what's the line, right? Where's the line? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, they find it pretty quickly, I think.
They do, yeah, yeah. I think after Ransom for a Dead Man, they find... you just have to leave it to Peter Falk, I guess, because if you write it, you know, you have a tendency to want to overwrite it or make him one of those tough guy, you know,
yeah.
McMahon and wife kind of detectives.
Well, and they specifically said they had like a list of things to never do, and like there was never going to be a car chase or a, you know, any kind of real action sequences,
which is good. I like that.
Which is good. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
They sort of break some of those rules in the 90s revival, but
yeah, well, there's that one episode that was not even a Columbo episode that they just turned into a Columbo episode that was pretty bad.
It was like they took a old like John Cervantes script and said, "Let's make this gangster thing in Columbo."
Yeah, right.
It's like a mobster thing in Columbo.
That's the one that has Ed Begley Jr. in it.
Oh, yeah, that's right, yeah.
Another Star Trek connection.
Another Star Trek connection.
And Columbo's wife.
And the back of Columbo's wife.
Falk's wife.
Oh, his real wife. His real wife.
Who turns up and ruins multiple episodes, actually.
And Ed Begley Jr. meets Kate Mulgrew in Star Trek. So.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. He meets the actual Mrs. Columbo. Mm-hmm. When Fox wife appears in the 90s revival, it's never a good time.
Not you should know.
It's no. Never a good time.
I will say the murder was clever.
Mm-hmm.
It was, yeah. It was a very clever murder, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's my big problem with the episode is that there is a good episode in here.
Yes.
That just needed some additional work.
It did. It needed to find the it needed to find the antagonist's humanity a little bit more,
mm-hmm.
and set up that this guy does know what he's doing.
Right.
And
yeah.
Like you said earlier, it's just we're being told a lot and we're not being shown a lot. There's the making of a good episode in here.
Yeah. I do like the sequence when they listen to the recording and Roddy McDowell's character, Roger, knows that they've taken the cigar out of the box. So he knows that he's on a clock and is hoping that the bomb doesn't go off while he's on the phone.
Yes.
And he keeps looking at his watch and he's looking at his watch and then it hangs up like right before. But of course, Columbo sees him looking at his watch and
thinks that's weird. There's always the moment where we as the audience see where Columbo gets the in, but Columbo already has the in the moment he meets the guy. Like he already knows. He like has this sixth sense of like,
yeah,
this is the guy. Not just because he's the guest star, but you know, because of just his instinct as a cop.
Yep.
But yeah, I like that. I like Roddy McDowell getting all pissy about it too. Like people do look at their watches.
Look at their watches. Yes. Yeah. 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 And here's where we get the great cable car scene, the first one where they're going up to the top and
he's so good.
Columbo hates it.
Yeah. Although I do want to mention though, Roddy McDowell does have a really amazing wardrobe in the scene where they're listening to the answering machine. His jacket is that pseudo
suede or whatever.
That suede pseudo pea coat is just fantastic. I mean, I think that's his one really awesome outfit in this that also does not show his bits and diddlies at the same time. but I do like the tram scene and the his body acting and then the whole like, I don't know, it's just downhill now. It's like, oh good. Yeah. Oh, I can go downhill now.
Yeah.
I mean, looking at that road, I would also be uncomfortable riding a car on that road.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, when I was a reporter and I had to drive in Los Altos Hills in the Bay Area, it is roads like that. And that's where all the rich houses are, where all the men and women and in tech who've made a lot of money live, right? And I actually had to cover almost a Columbo-like incident where like this wife shot her husband But she shot him in the foot. She didn't actually kill him. But they are long, windy roads, and they do find cars that have been there for years later of people who had just gone missing. So, yeah, it is very believable that that is a road that people would just and never hear that from them again.
I mean, I also would feel a lot like Columbo in that cable car, too, though.
Yes, me too. Yeah, me too. Too. I also have a fear of heights, so I am with Columbo. I could barely do the shard when I went all the way to the top and looked at the observation deck. I could only get so far to the window without.
I am definitely noticing with Ryan, you mentioned the slightly homoerotic removal of silly string from Columbo. I'm definitely seeing that as I'm skimming through here.
Oh yeah, for sure.
It is so.
And that is when he's wearing the pants.
He is wearing the pants.
I was like, my Roddy McDowell is in the Roger is into Columbo a little bit. He likes his middle-aged, daddies.
Well, I don't know how much Roddy McDowell had to act that or had to act that or not, or he'd draw on that, because I mean he was gay, so.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
Because I have never done any research on Roddy McDowell before watching this, other than knowing who he was. But like reading the Wikipedia, like I got to the part personal life. Roddy McDowell was never married. Oh, I know what that means.
Yes. What is it? Nathan Lane has this thing where he's talking about like how some reporter asked him if he was gay. And Nathan Lane said he was at 40 at the time. He said the reporter, "Yeah, I'm 40 years old. I do a lot of musical theater. You do the math."
But in the case of Roddy McDowell, it then also talks about a relationship that he had. So yes, it's not just that he was never married. But, But also, an actor in the 70s, a male actor in the 70s who was never married, you can usually read between the lines on that. Which they actually. They imply for the character too.
He's very heavily coded. In the very beginning,
because he talks about, he says, "What could you possibly have on a charming old bachelor like me?" Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and he does play it very fey.
In terms
of it,
it feels more than just queer coded to me. It feels like they are saying as much as they possibly could in the 70s.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I think that read is right, because his thing with Anne Francis doesn't feel like it's like...
Oh, no, he's just doing that to use her.
He's just using her. She's a beard, basically. And,
mm-hmm.
A useful beard, I should say, for him. Which I don't mind. I love it when shows have queer characters, even if they are the villain, right? I know there is a whole thing about are we villainized too much and all that stuff, but I also think in noir we can be the villain as much as we can be the hero. Is my view as a queer noir writer. I think like we just have to exist in stories, and I like that it's not called out. And it's not made a big deal of. He just exists, and he's like that, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's the better way to play it, instead of it being like, oh, you know, he's one of those type of things. Which might even be the subtext of his scenes with his uncle, too.
Possibly, yeah.
Because he does say, like, if your aunt didn't indulge you so much.
Mm-hmm.
A couple mm-hmm. of times, yeah.
All right, was there anything we haven't covered?
In the show or otherwise?
I do not envy you your task of editing this one.
Yes. It's you have. Jim always says this when I get to tricks. Every time you're on an episode, it becomes the longest episode we've done. I was like, oh man, I gotta stop talking.
No, Carl and I have definitely talked this long on our own before.
Oh, okay, good, good.
With just as many tangents.
Yes.
Because I also did another thing over the weekend, and he's like, this is probably going to be my longest one. I'm like, oh, why do I do this?
Oh, what was the topic?
It was screenwriting. It was he was asking me about he's 5 questions for a screenwriter is the YouTube thing. But he's like, this is gonna be my longest one. I'm like, oh God, I'm having a reputation. Time I guess somewhere, it's always the longest episode they've ever done.
What is our longest episode, Carl?
I was about to say, I think it's probably one of the ones where we had Chrissy on to poke holes in all the historical facts of Dan Brown movies.
Ooh, I'm going to go back and listen to that one.
I think we spent like almost 2.5 hours on the
We did all three of the Dan Brown movies with my Infinite Diversity co-host, Chrissy, who is a historian.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's got to be a good one. Oh, I love when the holes get poked into stuff. Mm-hmm. That's pop culture.
If I remember right, the title of the Da Vinci Code episode was There Are Things That Aren't Wrong.
Didn't we call one of them the Tuvix of Airport novels?
Yes, that was Angels and Demons. But it had nothing to, the title had nothing to do with Angels and Demons. It had to do with that weird amalgam book that was Michael Crichton and James Patterson.
That James Patterson, Michael Crichton book. Yes. That's right. Yes.
He is the Tuvix of those two.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That is absolutely the Tuvix of Airport novels.
Oh my God. Someone get me Janeway quick. Did I hear a Tuvix situation?
It's either going to be, I've never read it, so I don't know if it's like a whole bunch of science and then the James Patterson takes over, or if it's a James Patterson novel that has like charts in it.
So I still haven't read it either, but I remember Chrissy was reading the description of it, and mm-hmm. one of the reviews said that the first half goes deep into the science of volcanoes, and we all said, oh, that's the Michael Crichton part.
Let me spend an entire chapter telling you all the science.
And here are 15 references that I made up.
Michael Crichton. I saw Jurassic World Rebirth last week, and you can skip it.
Oh, really? Okay.
I haven't even watched the one before that one.
I thought you were going to say talking about people who were disappointing in real life.
So Michael Crichton, other than being an advocate for DDT, was he disappointing in real life?
I mean, he was a climate denier in that stupid book that he wrote.
Really? Well, that was part of the application.
I have not had the pleasure of meeting Michael Crichton.
But he wasn't. You don't have to worry about it now.
I mean, unless I dig him up, I don't know.
I mean, you have bigger things to worry about if he did that.
He's been dead for like 15 years at this point.
Yeah. So and he long. Still has books coming out, so that's interesting.
Yeah, that's the.
Him and that flowers in the attic person.
wasn't that Christopher Pike?
No, that's
Oh no, Schwab.
VC something or other.
VC Schwab. Yeah. Sorry, my sister was reading VC Schwab and Christopher Pike as a teenager, so I like reading all of those books around the same time, and I always confuse them. Not Christopher Pike, the.
Yes, I know who Christopher Pike, the writer, is. Yes, I know. I've never read one of his books, but I remember just he's also an airport rack guy that you always see. Yep. Yeah.
Well, Tom Clancy still has novels coming out, apparently.
He's not writing them.
The Tom Clancy ones are not actually Tom. The Michael Crichton ones are like they're like digging deep into his files and finding stuff.
Yeah.
The Tom Clancy ones are actually. They'll be titled Tom Clancy This, and it's written by some other person.
Yeah, yep. Yeah. It's kind of like the newer James Bond books, right? Ian Fleming's mm-hmm. James Bond, written by some other guy.
Yeah.
Which I have never read any of the ones that were not Ian Fleming written.
So mm-hmm. I should finish. When we were doing the movies for the podcast, I had been on a kick and was going through the books, but I never finished. I should actually. Do that. I remember just thinking, wow, how the hell was Live and Let Die even more problematic than the movie?
Because he uses certain words that weren't in the movie.
Oh, no.
I recall I was listening to Live and Let Die, the audiobook, and it was like in spring and my windows were open and I'm just like, I need to put in headphones right now.
Yes.
I can't have one of my neighbors hearing this.
Dad, what's going on over at your place? Nothing. It's James Bond. I swear it's James Bond.
And then there's like randomly there's one chapter where he shits on old people for no reason and no relevant reason to the plot, too.
Yeah.
They're of their time.
Oh, they are, because I read that he was a drug addict, so I wanted to go read. Like, he really is? Because that's not in the movies. I gotta look that up.
I really enjoyed Casino Royale, Moonraker, and Diamonds Are Forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The book.
Yeah. The book, yes.
To be clear,
I got where you were going with that. Not Mankiewicz's version of Diamonds Are Forever.
Baja.
Okay, so
I don't have anything in Baja.
So I have a beef against Tom Mankiewicz. It's a slight beef.
Okay.
A slight beef. Because he did the rewrite on Superman, right?
He actually how does he the man that wrote the script for Superman?
He was the one who made, because Mario Puzo's script is like
so terrible.
All over the place.
Yeah.
Tonally too. It's just tonally all over the place.
And oh man, Mario Puzo, you want to talk about a wild fucking book. The Godfather. Have you ever read it?
I haven't read the book, no. I've only seen the movie.
Oh my god, that book. The movie is so much better because there is so much weird shit that they cut from the book.
I might have to read the book now.
There is a very large subplot, pun not intended, about how Sonny Corleone is so hung that he ruins sex for every woman who has sex with him because no other man can ever please him.
Oh my god, that's worse than the Pussy Galore thing. Bond was so good that he turned a lesbian. Oh my god. Jesus Christ. Cishet writers, I swear. Yeah. Anyway. My god. But my beef with Tom, I don't have a beef like that with Tom Mankiewicz. My only beef is that they actually wanted to get Clark and Lois together at the end of Superman 2, and then like Lois would be like in on the secret, and then like so the next movies would have Lois being an active participant in helping Clark, right? Which actually Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster tried to do before National Comics, now DC, said, no, you can't do that because it'll kill the series. But Tom Mankiewicz said, no, Clark can never kiss Lois. We can never see that. And then they did the whole memory erase thing instead. And I was like, that's... Yeah.
Thank you so much for listening to us this episode. If you'd like to contact us, you can find us on Blue Sky at Podspiel. Podspiel. You can also find this episode and all back episodes of our show on our website, licensetospiel.com. That's license with a C. You can also find me on Blue Sky at Listening to Film.
And you can find me at Tyrannicus. That's TYRANICUS.
Well, first of all, thanks for joining us for this. It's been a lot of fun.
It has been very fun, yes.
How can people reach you online to get in touch, chat about Star Trek, Columbo, or whatever?
Whatever. Babylon 5 is my other interest. The Prisoner is my other interest. I am on Blue Sky. I am just simply at RyanThomasRiddle.com, which is their version of verification, I guess, is you use your website. So it's easy to find me on Blue Sky. And I'm Ryan Thomas Riddle, generally on Instagram and stuff. I'm no longer on Twitter. I finally deactivated it completely. I was just sitting on it, but I just completely deactivated it this week. You can also find me on my website, RyanThomasRiddle.com. And then also I have a newsletter now, which is distantworlds.io.ghost or ghost.io. One other way, it's on Ghost. And there's a link to it in my website anyway. So where I talk about my new project, which is a new science fiction universe and a queer love story between two men who must compete. One human, one alien, and must compete to become the captain of the first deep space exploration vessel of a new interstellar alliance.
Awesome.
Cool.
Next episode, we will be finally rounding out the first season of Columbo with the episode Blueprint for Murder.